This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 43% of Massachusetts stores were out of baby formula in the first week of May, according to Datassembly, a data analytics firm. It all roughly began, with the short-term shuttering of a baby formula factory owned by one of the major producers, Abbott Nutrition, due to safety concerns after bacterial infections in four infants. Two of those infants died. It has spiraled into massive nationwide shortages, with at times more than 40% of national chains, for example, out of stock. If that is all your infant can eat, or even just a key part of your baby's diet, that is a life-altering shortage. The Biden administration, feeling the heat, announced it is working with U.S. manufacturers to streamline production, get the plant back online, increase imports of formulas from overseas. All of it's going to take time, though. So how is that affecting parents and babies here? If this shortage has impacted you directly, we want to hear from you right now. Tweet us at Radio Boston, or if you're in our text group, text us 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. And we've already got some of that coming in. So we'll look forward to adding your voices to this story. We're joined here in the studio by the executive director of the Mother's Milk Bank Northeast, Deborah Youngblood, and WBUR's multi-platform editor who's been covering the issue, Megan Kelly. Megan, welcome.
Thank you.
Deborah, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
So, Megan, let's start with some of the coverage. You've been really tracking this issue. What have you seen as the impact of this shortage here in the Commonwealth?
Yeah, so I talked to last week a couple parents in the area who have been struggling to find formula for their infants, and they're really stressed. They're really worried that they can't find the sustenance that their baby needs. You know, a couple people told me that they haven't been able to find stuff for a couple of weeks, and they've been calling stores, and they're all out of stock, or, you know, you can only buy one or two cans at a time. It's very stressful if you have a baby who, you know, babies under a year are really only supposed to consume formula or breast milk, and if you can't have, if you don't have access to that, it's like, what do you do? It's terrifying. It's really scary to think about.
Have you spoken with anybody who's out, who is at a moment where they don't have a way to feed their infant?
Yeah. So I talked to Estefania Rodriguez. She lives in Haverhill, and she has a daughter who's about 5 months old, Liliana. And Liliana has a milk protein allergy, which means that she can only have a very specific type of hypoallergenic formula. And Estefania has been able to find stuff from about a month ago, but she is very worried that her supply is going to run out and she's not going to be able to find anymore.
We would be lucky and find three cans here and there. You know, they were at like $42. A couple weeks went by and they bumped up the price to $63.99. For one can. Mind you, at the time, my baby was still like 3 months old, eating every 3 hours. Like, one can will literally last me 3 days at the most. And you're telling me that $63 for one can just because of the shortage?
So it's really like, that really scared you. I mean, and my heart really went out to her because my son, who is now 10, had a similar kind of allergy, and the formula that I could get for him was in this tiny can. It was $25 a can, but it was a really small can that only made a couple of bottles. And it's terrifying to think, even 10 years on, it's terrifying to think that I couldn't feed him.
So I'm going to bring Deborah, you into the conversation now, and this is going to be a wide-ranging chat, I think, but I want to start with, I'm assuming your organization has been getting more calls since this shortage. So maybe yes and no on that, and tell us a bit about what Mother's Milk Bank Northeast does and how it works.
Sure, absolutely. So yeah, our phones have absolutely been ringing off the hook. Interestingly, we're sort of hearing from both sides. So, you know, we're hearing from a lot of moms who want to be part of the solution, and they're reaching out and saying, how can I become a milk donor? I want to help feed another baby. And that's, of course, a beautiful response.
And to clarify, those have to be people who are lactating now.
They do. They do. So we're really looking for, you know, women who are lactating now and whose own baby is getting everything that they need, and she has more supply beyond that. So those are the moms who can donate. And there's a full screening process that happens and, you know, testing that needs to go on for our product particularly. But of course, as Megan said, you know, we're also hearing from frantic parents, parents who are looking for new options for their babies. Nonprofit milk banks, our primary mission is to provide safe, pasteurized donor human milk to medically fragile babies. So most of our milk is going to neonatal intensive care units in hospitals all throughout the northeastern U.S. When we have milk beyond that, and we often do, then we're able to supply families with small amounts. So it's really what we consider bridge milk. It's a very short-term option for people.
So are you feeling like you're seeing a moment where the supply of these kinds of alternatives, there's no way to meet the need that we could be facing?
I think that, you know, nonprofit milk banks are a piece of the puzzle, but we won't be able to resolve the infant formula sort of shortage and this crisis alone. We're excited to be, you know, a solution, and we want to try to help parents as best we can. That's a big part of our mission. I think it also speaks to, you know, looking at the longer term. Parents need this crisis resolved right now, and that's going to take health officials and, you know, the federal government, as you've talked about. But I think if we take the long view, I think that there's a bigger role for milk banks in the future, and we're really poised for that growth. And I also think that, you know, there's a conversation to be had about how do we better support moms for whom breastfeeding is a desirable choice and a medically available option for them and their babies to breastfeed. I think we could perhaps become less reliant on formula companies as a country.
Okay, so I want to put a couple of things in place here, and then, Megan, I'm going to come back to you. First, I want to pick up a comment from one of our texting group members. This is Joanne in Chelmsford. And Joanne texted in, quote, "My daughter's now an adult, but I've seen a lot on social media from people telling new moms to just breastfeed. And it's not as simple as that. Some moms choose to use formula or cannot breastfeed. This is an important part of the conversation," end quote. And I brought Joanne there because there are two caveats I want to place on the table now, both for listeners, for us to be mindful. One, we are having this conversation in a charged environment. Here in the New England region and larger nationally, there's a lot of tension and controversy and conversations about formula versus breastfeeding, what's choice, what's necessity. Also in an environment where breastfeeding can equal pumping and producing milk in other environments, which can also be complicated. I want to name all of that as we go forward with this conversation. I also want to name that there's a lot about gender. And gender identity that's in this conversation as well. You know, I'm mindful that there are some people, for example, who prefer the phrase chest feeding to breastfeeding. So I just want to note that there's a gender dimension to the conversation we're having, and that there's controversy here that's sitting in the middle of the table, and that I think in different ways we've probably all experienced. I know I did with my two kids. So thanks for letting me flag that. Megan, let me turn back to you there to pick it up.
Yeah, so I think it's a couple things that come to mind when you're talking about that. One is that, you know, back when my kids were both of a nursing age, people would say things to me like, oh, breastfeeding is free. And, you know, I did nurse both of my kids supplemented with formula. It was a great experience, but it was very difficult. It's only free if you consider a woman's time to be worth nothing. It meant, you know, free, sure, yes, but I had to get up every 2 hours in the middle of the night. You know, my husband wasn't getting up with them because they were breastfeeding. I had to pump at work, and that didn't work out for me all the time, so it was really hard. You know, there one thing that my pediatrician had said to me is that the baby needs to be fed, and there's no judgment with that, right? It's not a moral choice. The baby needs to be fed. If it's formula, if it's breast milk, if it's you get breast milk from a bank, whatever it is, right? The baby needs to be fed, and that's the most important thing. And I hope that people can understand that, you know, it's not always the easiest thing to do in the world, whatever you decide to do, but whatever you decide to do is really what's best for you and your family, and that people need to understand that what might have worked for you isn't going to work for everybody else.
So I'm going to pick up another submission from our texting club. This is Keiko in Swampscott. Quote, "I had an NPR driveway moment. listening to a podcast about the shortage and found myself sobbing listening to stories of mothers just trying to feed their babies. I remember what it was like to be that mom 9 years ago. My son was a preemie who needed specialty formula that was expensive and hard to find. And that was 9 years ago when there was no national shortage. I couldn't stop thinking about those moms of preemies who are having trouble now, and I just felt compelled to do something about it. I know how to build websites. I know how to do marketing, so I created freeformulaexchange.com. As a simple solution to solve for the complex problem. So there's more from Keiko, but I want to pick it up there because I want to ask both of you to talk about, okay, so babies have to eat. We have this crazy shortage. And before we finish, I want to talk about how we got here a little bit too. People will have to solve for the problem. There are safe ways to do that. There are unsafe ways to do that. There are voluntary ways to do that. There are financial ways to do that. So let's talk a little bit in that space. Let's talk about safety, Deborah, and thinking about how to volunteer or be supportive from a milk bank standpoint, but also make sure that there is quality and safety there.
Yeah, I think that that's really important in this moment. And I just want to reiterate what you were both saying as well, which is that parents have, excuse me, a lot going on. And judgment does not have a place in this conversation right now. We need to be solution oriented. That said, I think that, you know, and I know people have heard this and it may not be what they're wanting to hear at this moment, but you really have to talk to your pediatrician. Because infant nutrition is critically important. It's always important, but that first year of development is a really critical year. And so you need to talk to your pediatrician to try to work through your specific situation and ensure that your baby is getting only a safe nutritional product.
And Megan, and this idea of formula exchanges, are you seeing informal networks pop up of how people are trading goods and helping each other out? And also cautions, no-nos, don't do this while you're trying to solve your problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So this morning we had a brief segment, and then it's also on our website right now.
WBUR.org.
Yep, WBUR.org, about this local group on Facebook called the Formula Fairies. If you go on Facebook, it's like the Formula Fairies of Greater Boston and Southern New Hampshire. It's five moms who really just wanted to help other people. It's kind of like a matchmaking thing. People will say, oh, I need this kind of formula. And other people will say, oh, okay, great. I'm going food shopping today. If they have it, I'll grab it for you. And then, you know, we can meet up to exchange it. So that's really heartening to see. I think it was the woman that I talked to, Ariane DeLovo, was just like, she just really wanted to help. And it was such a wonderful thing to see moms helping other moms and other caregivers just kind of find that stuff. The other thing, last week for the formula shortage story, I talked to a pediatric GI at Children's who was very keen to say, please do not make your own formula. It is a very delicate balance of electrolytes, nutrition, vitamins, et cetera. I've seen some homemade recipes floating around on the internet. Please don't use them. You know, they can cause dehydration. They can cause an electrolyte unbalance. They're not safe. And so, like Deborah said, you really need to talk to your doctor about it because they're going to know what is best for your baby. And they might also have samples that they can give you as well.
So, Deborah, I want to change hats with you because you were Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the City of Newton for 6 years. So somebody who's been in a Health and Human Services administration, how do you size up the moment we're in and what solutions do you expect to see the government, local governments provide? We talked about what the Biden administration is and isn't doing, but wear that hat for a sec.
Yeah. So, you know, when we find ourselves in these kinds of scenarios, it's a lot of pressure on local governments because ultimately we rely on our state and our federal partners. And, you know, I think that one of the things that I know from having been the health commissioner is the role of the FDA and the necessity of being very stringent in terms of food safety regulations and making sure that those factories who are producing a product that's going to the most vulnerable among us, or some of the most vulnerable among us, they have to be diligent in that work. At the same time, you know, we saw a vacuum, right? It took too long for us to move forward and to begin to really kind of feel that fire and say, like, you know, we're at this crisis point, like we need formula now.
Yeah, to that point, the lab shut down like in February.
Right.
And that was after a warning from last fall that took several months to unfold. So Megan, you know, a couple minutes left. What are we hearing on the policy front now? Or what are you hearing people are hoping to see from government and private sector now?
So one thing that I believe we learned yesterday was that Abbott is going to start reopening one of its factories. They're working with the government, you know, to make sure that everything is safe and clean. But it's still going to take maybe 6 to 8 weeks for them really to get back into, you know,
full
previous
production.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I'm seeing a lot is that people were a little dismayed that it took so long. I mean, this has been happening since February. And, you know, I feel terrible that I didn't know about it, but I don't have any babies in my circle. I don't have any babies in my house. But a lot of, like, legislators didn't know either. And I think there's a real desire out there for people. They want the people representing them in Congress and at the State House to know that, like, you should be up on top of this stuff. You should know it. This shouldn't have happened. You know, if one factory goes offline, then maybe there could have been other ways to mitigate this without just letting it happen.
All right. I think we're going to end there. That is Megan Kelly, WBUR's multi-platform editor, and Deborah Youngblood, the executive director of the Mother's Milk Bank Northeast. Megan, thanks.
Thanks so much, Tiziana.
And Deborah, thank you.
Glad to be here.
And we appreciated those who submitted comments to us, too. If you'd like to join our texting group, and we hope you will, I can't wait to hear from you. Get started by texting the word BOSTON to 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. Kendall Square. When you think of it, what do you picture? Probably MIT, NASA, Google, Biogen. Things like that. But how about factories making rubber, horse-drawn carriages, Necco wafers? It is all true. All of them are part of the history of what's considered by many to be one of the world's most innovative square kilometers. These companies, their role in the ecosystem of Kendall Square, are the subject of a new book called Where Futures Converge, Kendall Square and the Making of a Global Innovation Hub. In it, author and reporter Robert Buderi explores the history of the square, its challenges. For example, for all of its people and businesses in innovation, not a single pharmacy exists in Kendall Square. How can a hub fully support people without services like that? It's really a fascinating discussion about how something grows up, what it does right, and maybe what it's getting wrong. So here to have that conversation with us, Robert Buderi, who joins me in the studio. Robert, Bob, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you know this was going to be an interesting story to tell? How'd you get started writing this book?
Well, I've lived and worked in Kendall Square for almost since like mid-80s. You know, I had a fellowship at MIT, then I was editor of Technology Review magazine of MIT, which was based there. I was a fellow again at MIT. I started my own company, my media company, Xconomy, there. So I've been part of that ecosystem for decades, and I knew both the incredible density of innovation, like you talked about, but also the challenges it faced. And I felt like that story from day one of Cambridge founding, you know, in the 1600s to today just had not been told, and that there was a great narrative story there.
All right. So I want to pick up the day one of Cambridge founding in the 1600s, because I admit as I was starting the book, I was like, yeah, I just don't think of Kendall Square as 1600s. So take us back to why that was the place that you started with this story.
Well, I started with the story, not that Kendall Square was actually even a place then,
right,
because it was marshland. But Harvard and Cambridge were founded in the early 1600s. And people were looking almost from the start, how do we get there directly? And there used to be this old path, if you wanted to go by land all the way around, you know, 8 miles around through Boston Neck. Later there became a ferry in Charleston. But this spot of Kendall Square was a natural kind of quick destination point to get to Harvard and places west and north. So people had their eye on it to make money and to have, you know, business centers there from early on. But it wasn't until the late 1700s, 1793, that the West Boston Bridge, now called the Longfellow Bridge, was built. And that kind of kicked off the era of you know, commerce.
And if you look across sort of the history, so I think about when people say maybe we lived closer to the time of the T-Rex than we did something else. It seems like it was just recently, right? We live closer to a time when really what Kendall Square was mostly about was manufacturing and machines and things like that, really than the innovation we think of it as today.
Well, that's true in a lot of ways, but one of the surprises for me was that it was not just a huge factory town starting in the late second half of the 1800s and into the first 30 years until the Depression in the 1930s, but it was also a center of innovation long before MIT even got there. So that was, we think of it as part and parcel with MIT, and it is today, but it wasn't always the case. It was this, this accessible place for workforce, for commerce in Boston, and it was cheap land at the time. Now it's some of the most expensive land in the world.
So that is fascinating because as I read the book, it seems to me what you're trying to do with this book is draw a set of lessons that about a place that has become what it is partly intentionally and partly unintentionally.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
But where maybe if somebody really paid attention, a community could create something fully intentionally elsewhere. Is that right? Is that the lesson?
Well, people are trying all over the world. People come and came certainly before the pandemic to Kendall Square to try to learn the secret of the ecosystem of it and greater Boston. How much of it is replicable? It's uncertain because there was a funny story that Charlie Baker was on a panel one time and he was asked, how do you create a center of innovation? He said, it's easy. And everybody's kind of taken aback. And he said, yeah, you get MIT and Harvard to come to your city and you wait 150 years. So, how you get that. But one of the keys for Kendall Square is these competing centers of excellence that not just Harvard and MIT, but the great universities around here, the great companies, all those things coming together to kind of foster and foment innovation.
So I want to interrogate that. There are like three different places I want to go
once. Yeah.
But we'll start there and I'll interrogate that. There was a voice playing in my head, right, as I'm reading the book that's saying, okay, but if you take certain kinds of companies, certain kind of founders, right, which we know from the venture world and the founder world, et cetera, was going to be white men of an educated class for at least the last 50 years. Always up until fairly recently. And then you take an institution like MIT, which sources brilliant people, but with a mindset that comes in part through their education. Are you creating a hotbed of a type of innovation that's possible with those ingredients? But are you locking out innovations because there are ingredients that can't enter that mix, whether that's racial and ethnic diversity ingredients, gender ingredients, geographic location ingredients, lived experience ingredients, et cetera?
Yeah, these are great questions, and there's not an easy answer or solution to this. But yes is a short one, that you are in danger of locking out certain groups or elements of innovation. And I'd add to that the startup, as part of that mix of diversity, because with the expensive, huge new buildings and expensive space, when I started my company there in 2007, it was $23 a square foot in Kendall Square. Now it's like 100 and something, and the startup can't afford it. So all these things are happening, and I try to look at that in the book in this narrative fashion, and one of the big chapters is about an effort at MIT by former President Susan Hockfield and two professors, Sangeeta Bhatia and Nancy Hopkins, to increase the opportunities for women faculty, especially in biological sciences, to get into that that stream that creates companies, and because they did a study of the data at MIT, and if women faculty had been founding companies at the rate male faculty were, there'd be 40 more companies just in the last dozen years or so.
So the 40 missing companies.
40 missing companies is the name of that chapter.
Yeah. All right. I'm glad we interrogated that. We're jumping back and forth here. I want to pick up here and I want to go back in time now. Because part of what was interesting to me about learning the lessons of how you either intentionally or unintentionally create spaces for innovation and employment boom and new industries, et cetera, was a particular relationship between city government and people participating in their city government in Cambridge and decisions about what could and couldn't happen in Kendall Square. And I think our standard narrative is this is all the business people and maybe some researchers who do this and they make it all happen. But actually, the community of Cambridge and its individual citizens and the choices they made at the voting booth, et cetera, really affected how things unfolded. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is this mishmash of how, you know, cities and ecosystems develop. And it's part intentional and part unintentional. And even the intentional part often has unintentional consequences. Yeah. And that one place that really jumped home was in the effort when molecular biology and recombinant DNA kind of surfaced in the 70s and as a potential business opportunity. And people were talking about, you know, combining genes. And the city mayor at the time, Al Bellucci, you know, hit the brakes on that. The ethical concerns, but the safety concerns. Like, what is nobody knew, not even the scientists. What's going to happen? You start combining genes. And so there were all these public hearings. It was international news. There was, you know, fanfare, all this stuff. And the city of Cambridge, deliberately, they put a citizens working group, no scientists on it, you know, a nurse, a historian, all these different people from the community to study this issue. And they came up with a set of rules for how you could do recombinant DNA.
So I'm going to pause you there, just because people listening might jump to, okay, no scientists that come up with a set of rules. That might suggest something capricious or random or incomplete. But you're quite clear in the book that this was a group that took the responsibility seriously.
Yeah, can you imagine what it would like to have citizens really take their responsibility seriously and not just spout out, you know, a talking point? I mean, they spent a year or more studying this issue, interviewing many scientists. They had scientific advisors, all those things. But they set out these very well-considered rules that were accepted by the scientific community as well. Now, that this was not capricious in any way. But it was funny because people thought, well, okay, we got these rules. No company's going to start, you know, biotech. Nobody's going to start a biotech company in Cambridge.
Because it's too onerous.
Too onerous. But it actually had the opposite effect because it was the first ordinance about recombinant DNA in the world. And it, unlike Boston or any city around here or any city, you know, in San Francisco Bay Area, there were rules. So a company knew what they were getting into. And so therefore, you could bring your company here and know what you had to deal with, as opposed to starting it, say, even in Boston, you didn't know what the community response would be. You had this uncertainty that was very hard to live with. So Biogen was the first company to move its they were based in Europe, but they moved their R&D headquarters here. And it ended up igniting the biotech industry here in a way that nobody foresaw. So that's one example.
Yeah, and it is fascinating because, again, our narrative is that industry does this alone, right? Yeah. But in this case, it was an enabling framework from everyday citizens in a community that created the conditions for an entire industry to explode here in Kendall Square.
Yeah, that's really true. And of course, there are tensions ongoing, you know, always tensions with the business community, citizens, and so forth. But that was a real example of what you just described.
All right. So fast forward to today, because, you know, we often talk about with Kendall Square, it's a small area. It's very expensive. Only a handful of people really can afford to live there. Businesses now, you have to be one of the big businesses to be able to afford space there, some amenities, but not a complete neighborhood. Yeah. So with that in mind, one of the first chapters is about City Space Volpe model at MIT Media Lab, which is this, you know, it's like a Tony Stark thing where you can lay out the city and then you can move things around and run systems dynamics to say, if we put this here, what would happen? And if we move this here? So let's say you could, right? What would you add and subtract to Kendall Square today to make it the ecosystem that's good for as many people as possible and continues to support innovation.
I mean, I think you have to look at, as someone who actually had a condo in Kendall Square and their company, you have to look at the amenities, the elements of city and neighborhood life, you know, pharmacy. There is a grocery store that opened just in late 2019, I think it was.
Yeah, but that's kind of crazy. Late 2019 before there's a food market.
Yeah, liquor store was first. That was on the checklist. And then there was a drugstore and a grocery store. They got two out of three, but just one of each.
Yeah.
And the pharmacy reportedly is coming. But it's not just that. It's affordable housing and affordable for, you know, the mix of housing. Many things have been tried. There's now an ordinance that says if you're going to build more than, I think it's 20 new housing units, you know, 20% have to be affordable. Things like that.
And there's always controversy around those thresholds and whether they're sufficient.
But I think you have to look at that. But to get those elements, to integrate, Kendall Square's got this unique density that, you know, Silicon Valley is bigger in terms of numbers all over the place. But there's nothing as dense as Kendall Square. So what's the challenge to really integrate that with the community, which is right there? The neighborhoods are all around it. You know, so how do you integrate that? I think I don't have the answers, but those are questions that if Kendall Square could solve or address in advance, that would be a huge leg up on the next iteration of whatever Kendall Square becomes. Because I think to tap into, to continue to innovate, you don't just come out of a pandemic and try to get back what we had. You try to say, you know, how can we be better than ever? And I think connecting to the community is part of it, and maybe bringing in the arts and adding that element to innovation, I think would be an amazing step forward.
Well, so much there. We didn't even get to the compare and contrast with the Seaport, which I think could have been a whole separate conversation. But that is Robert Bouderi, journalist and author of the new book, Where Futures Converge, Kendall Square and the Making of a Global Innovation Hub. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to college. Greater Boston is a city of ideas. It's big thinkers, big discoveries, and well over 100 colleges and universities in the state, although the exact count varies a lot by the source, so we'll stay in that rough space. If you went to college, you will remember that there was always a popular class that everyone wanted to take, and we're going to bring you some of those classes, abridged, of course, here in our new regular feature, Brilliant Boston. We will learn together about our world's most important subjects, the biggest ideas, with people who teach them the best, and then what those people are doing with those ideas in their own work. Today, we go to Suffolk University Law School and Professor Stephen Cody's seminar on mass incarceration. Professor Stephen Cody, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so listen, since we're in class, Sydney, the producer, and I were talking earlier. When I taught, I always wanted to be called professor. But are you Professor Cody in classroom, or are you Stephen in the classroom?
I usually go by Cody, actually, best friends call me Cody, too. So
all right,
it works.
So Cody it is. That's where we'll settle down on this. All right, so tell us about this seminar. What does mass incarceration even mean, and why is it so important to understand it here in the U.S.?
Yeah, well, the seminar evolved basically because students were very interested and concerned about the number of people that are incarcerated in the United States. And more students have been interested in sort of abolitionism and criminal justice reform. And so, you know, I offered to teach the class as an upper-level seminar, effectively to give students an opportunity to talk through some of the really challenging issues around reform, or for some, you know, how to rethink the system completely.
And when we use the term mass incarceration, that's a conscious choice. That's a term. What does it mean? And why are we confronting particular challenges in the U.S. about it?
Yeah, so there is a presumption in the course that our levels of incarceration are too high here in the United States. And I think that's empirically supported. I mean, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the incarcerated people around the world. So that is a starting place. And then the question is, well, why is that the case? And so we look to history, we look to different scholars and theories of how incarceration has developed over time. And then we work through a series of sort of compelling issues. So we look at bail reform. We look at the progressive prosecutor movement. You know, because of all the debates around defunding the police. This year, we spent a week talking about defunding the police and whether or not that's a good idea and how that would work. So every year, the seminar evolves. And, it's a great group because we get students who are from families that are police officers, third-generation police officers that want to be district attorneys. We get people who want to be public defenders. We get folks who are abolitionists and want to see the whole system, demolished. So it's really a great place to have, I think, deeper conversations about criminal justice reform.
So let's walk this through a little bit. What do they learn that surprises them the most, or maybe surprised you the most in putting the course together, about the history of how we got to this place of over-incarceration in the United States?
So I think a lot of students come to the course, having read The New Jim Crow, being familiar with Michelle Alexander's work, and really thinking about mass incarceration as a byproduct of the war on drugs. And also, thinking about our high levels of incarceration as mostly related to drug offenses. And, while that's true at the federal level, it's not true at the state level. And that's where most of the action is. That's where 80-some percent of people are incarcerated. And so what we talk a lot about is the power of prosecutors to make decisions, the growth in the number of prosecutors, line prosecutors, and the fact that really, if you're serious about decarceration, you have to look beyond nonviolent drug offenses. I mean, nonviolent drug offenses are maybe 14% of the overall incarcerated population. So you could let everyone out tomorrow and you would still have one of the highest incarceration rates in certainly the Western world. And so what do we do about people who have committed a violent offense but are different people? We're all better than the worst thing we've ever done. And we're all different people 10, 20 years later. And so how do we think about reincorporating citizens, after there has been a conviction and punishment. So we talk about reentry. We talk about, various themes.
All right. So there is a track of assumption and understanding in our public conversation around mass incarceration that says, given what we know about disproportionate incarceration, both of the total population and of the population of color and of men of color and of black men in America, that at the federal level, there is a very strong relationship with the history of drug policy and discriminatory drug policy. A, am I right on that?
There is certainly at the federal level, long drug sentences, sometimes often for nonviolent offenses. And there continue to be many, many people incarcerated at the federal level. The important thing to remember is that the federal incarceration system is really small compared to, the state systems. And so if you're serious about criminal justice reform, you have to focus on the states. And one thing that I try to get across to the students, too, is we don't have a criminal justice system in America. We have at least 3,144 criminal justice system.
What does that mean?
It means every county has different criminal codes. Every district attorney's office has a different culture and different sort of theories of prosecutions and priorities. Every county has, different funding structures for public defenders. And so criminal justice operates very, very differently in different places in the United States. And it's really important to sort of narrow in on individual counties and states when we're thinking about reform.
So here in Massachusetts, the two key ideas from that then are, A, we will have more people experiencing incarceration through state and local systems than federal prisons in Massachusetts.
Sure.
Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true everywhere. I mean, that's true everywhere that, last time I checked, I think it's 87% of prisoners are in, state and local jails and prisons.
B, the balance of the nature of those convictions is different at the state and local level than it would be at the federal level in terms of violent crime versus drug offenses versus other types of offenses.
That's right, yeah. So, for instance, more than half of the incarcerated population are incarcerated for violent offenses. That doesn't necessarily mean that those individuals are violent people, but it does mean that they have committed a violent offense. And so if you're serious, again, about meaningful reform, you know, you have to talk about violence. And of course, we focus on one type of violence, which is physical bodily violence. But of course, there are lots of types of violence in society. You know, a lack of opportunity, racial inequality, over-policing of particular communities. I mean, those are all types of violence. And so one of the things we do in the course is we really talk about, you know, how do we think about violence and how do we think about its relationship to criminal justice? And you know, I think no matter what your perspective is when you come into the seminar, my goal is for you to come out having critically evaluated, you know, those assumptions. And we do see people, you know, change their mind. I had a student, a brilliant black woman in the class this semester who came in and she really wanted to be a progressive prosecutor. You know, she thought that was the best way to help her community. And at the end, she said, you know what? I've become more and more convinced that the power of these institutions is so great that actually I think I might do public defense. I think I'm more inclined to this sort of abolitionist perspective. And the flip happens as well. I have people who come in and they want to be public defenders, and then they see, boy, you know, prosecutors are really powerful and they have incredible discretion. And if I'm interested in making a big difference for my community, you know, wouldn't it be great to have that power, to have more people like me in a DA's office? And so they become, you know, assistant district attorneys and they decide to go into the prosecution of crime. And so, you know, the course is really intended to have a deep, meaningful conversation about real reform in real places and to acknowledge, of course, you know, some of the inequalities in the system. So we talk a lot about race. We talk a lot about poverty. We talk increasingly about sort of gender inequalities.
So I'm going to ask you to hit a couple of those key themes there in race, quality, gender, inequality. Gender themes. And I'm going to note your whiteness in this too, right? Sure. You're coming to this, you're teaching this class as a white man. Mm-hmm. So both to note and to invite you to talk about how you bring that lens into it too as you hit these big themes.
Sure. Well, first off, I should say that I think that it is all of our responsibility, and particularly those of us who are teaching criminal justice, to teach race. I mean, it can't be the case that faculty of color assume the burden of teaching all race classes. And the other point, of course, is, you know, I also am part of a racial category, and in fact, one that's implicated in these systems of inequality in profound ways. So I think that that's an important starting place. I also do think, you know, I am privileged that I grew up in a working class, diverse neighborhood in West Philadelphia. I went through public schools in Philly. I was in very diverse communities for a long time. And that helped reveal to me white privilege. You know, whiteness is a second chance. Whiteness makes it easier sometimes for people to see your potential. And I saw lots of people in my community who were not getting second chances, who were not being seen for the talented people with aspirations for bigger things. And so, you know, I try to bring some of that to the classroom. And then last, I would say, look, I'm trained as a sociologist. And so I bring a lot of sociology into the classroom. And there are different ways to talk about race. You can talk about the experience of racism, in which case I would be not a good professor to probably teach that topic. But I talk mostly about structural inequalities. I talk mostly about patterns of inequalities. Why are particular communities being over-policed? Why are black men sentenced, you know, more harshly? Why are bail decisions made differently for different, you know, racial groups? You know, so I can talk about those sociological, systematic patterns of inequality, regardless of who I am. And students bring a wealth of their own experiences, of course, to the classroom. So we do have meaningful conversations about racism as well.
So recognizing then, stipulating that those are all things, right? Everything that you just said is a thing that is real and part of this mass incarceration picture. As you begin to move into solutions, pretend our listeners here at home are in class and you're going to give them a quick overview of, I don't mean to be dismissive by quick, but an overview of the types of solutions that are important to discuss if people want to delve further into this on their own, for example.
Yeah. Look, there's so many important areas of criminal justice reform right now. There's a lot of action on bail reform so that people who can't afford bail aren't stuck incarcerated for months or years. That's a really important topic. There's a lot of conversation about prosecutors and how they should use their discretion and be more transparent.
For example, as Rachel Rollins did when she was a Suffolk County DA with her list of lower-level crimes that she approached differently, and there's early data to suggest it may be working.
Sure, yeah. And you know, there's been a real movement nationwide towards trying to have DAs that are reformers, that are trying to sort of bring a more progressive ideal to district attorneys' offices. You know, one of the challenges is that district attorneys' offices are institutions, you know, with career prosecutors, and how you create that change so that it lasts, so that it's meaningful, really, I think, involves working with people in the office to create new protocols, to collect data, to be more transparent about your decision-making. But so that's another great area to focus on, I think, is the power of prosecutors and how we can think differently about public accountability for prosecutors' offices. You know, they're funded by the taxpayers, too. We expect a lot more transparency from the police than we do from prosecutors' offices.
Do you talk about the role of law enforcement in this, local law enforcement at all?
Sure, yeah. As I said, you know, often we have law enforcement in the class, or at least the children of law enforcement. And, you know, law enforcement has various roles to play. And we talk about, you know, alternatives to policing, but also, you know, how you can do policing better. You know, one thing we don't think about a lot, I think, with policing is there's a lot of trauma involved in policing. And so how do you address, you know, the trauma of police officers in order to ensure that they can de-escalate, that they, you know, can be full participants in with members of the community? You know, how do you work more closely with local organizations? And what are some of the alternatives to having, you know, more police? So we talk about all those things. And at its core, we're really concerned about, you know, how do we make criminal justice more responsive to local communities in a way that brings positive change and doesn't always look to lock people up as the solution.
All right. That is a perfect place to end. Cody, Professor Stephen Cody of Suffolk University Law School. His course on mass incarceration is one of the school's most popular. Thanks for taking us to school. I learned a ton today. Really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Thanks for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles, with Francisca Monahan and Sarah Leeson. We had help today from Amy Moon. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.